Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 1st. NYPD, take a knee, chanters chanted over the weekend here in the city. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue our coverage of the uprisings against police brutality here in New York and around the country. And with me now, Ijeoma Oluo, author of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling book, So You Want to Talk About Race, and her forthcoming Mediocre, The Dangerous Legacy of White Male America. She is Seattle-based and joins us from there. Ijeoma, we really appreciate you making time for us, and I know it's early out there. Welcome to WNYC.
Hello.
So it's not new, obviously, that incidents of police brutality get caught on video and make the news. Why do you think the killing of George Floyd was the final straw to a nationwide response like the country hasn't seen in 50 years?
You know, I think that it's really just a culmination of what has really been a brutal couple of years, especially for Black America. This is, you know, coming off of the murder of so many other Black people in this country. But also, I think we're right in the middle of a health crisis that is disproportionately impacting Black people in this country. And I think that, you know, when you are a Black person, you have kind of your reserves that keep you going, right? You try to ignore certain problems, let certain things go, because the truth is that if we felt the full impact of the systemic racism in this country all of the time, we would not be able to survive it. But I think that whatever reserves we've had as a people were already spent. They've been spent by watching Black people die at alarming, disproportionate numbers from this virus, and then watching, you know, our president ratchet up his racist rhetoric, and knowing that we've been disproportionately impacted by job loss, and that many people of color, including Black people, are also putting their lives at risk doing essential work for low pay. So we didn't really have the reserves to help us get through this and to realize that in the midst of a pandemic, that violent white supremacy doesn't stop, that it still comes for you. To realize that cops would risk their own health and risk getting COVID-19 themselves just to have the opportunity to kill a Black man in front of this whole country. I think it is hitting us very, very hard. And we really just don't have any reserves to be able to absorb that right now.
Yeah. And when you say no reserves and say people are spent, to use the word spent, besides the grief and the anger, I've been hearing the word exhaustion, which has been in our national vocabulary a lot anyway the last few years, especially for people of color. And the word exhaustion is being spoken a lot. I wonder if you're feeling or want to reflect on exhaustion as a relevant emotion in these times.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the truth is that our mental energy is an energy like anything else, right? Our brain is a muscle. And what it takes to recover from these sorts of events is a lot of energy, but we really can't because we are being hit one after the other after the other. And I am exhausted. And, you know, I was saying to my partner last night, I have some deadlines and some work I was trying to do. And I said, how is a Black person supposed to get anything done in this country? How am I supposed to shift my brain from the unending terror and grief of what is being done to us to what I need to do to be able to feed my family? It is so exhausting. I wish that non-Black people in this country understood the amount of mental energy that is taken up to deal with anti-Blackness and violent white supremacy in this country. I can't imagine what we would be able to accomplish if we didn't have to deal with this all of the time.
Let's take a phone call. Julie in Bushwick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I went to the protest on Friday and Saturday. I should say that I'm white, and I've always been like kind of conflicted about destruction that can come from protests. But then particularly Saturday, going and seeing and hearing mothers and sisters and brothers who have lost loved ones at the hands of the people that are supposed to protect them. And then, you know, their streets aren't safe. And then you hear the chant, "Whose streets are streets?" And you see a cop car burning or a major corporation on fire in a historically Black community. The narrative becomes really clear. And I kind of had like a, I had a moment this weekend of really understanding that that destruction is all a part of the demonstration, like demonstrating why these streets need to be taken back. And I had a long talk with my mom about all of that, and I understand it's like confusing and hard to understand destruction happening, but it kind of also creates such a clear narrative for me personally. I understood that this weekend.
Thank you very much. Ijoma, thinking anything in relation to that caller?
Yeah, you know, I actually had this conversation with my son earlier. He's 12 years old. And, you know, children, you try to raise them with morals, and things are very black and white to children. And he was very disturbed by the destruction he was seeing. You know, and here in Seattle, of course, we had some major destruction of big businesses in the downtown area as well. And he really wanted me to say, this is unequivocally wrong. And I couldn't say it to him, and he was really disturbed. And what I realized, sadly, is he doesn't have the cumulative trauma yet to understand how it gets to this. He hasn't seen time and time again people who look like him being treated as less valuable than property, to understand why, in order to be listened to, some people would start to come for property. And it really made me sad, you know, to say, one day you'll get it. And it's not because you don't have the intellectual capacity. It's because one day you'll have that trauma, and then you'll understand. And that's really what we're looking at. This is lifetimes, multiple generations of extreme trauma. This is what it looks like when you tell Black people for over 400 years that that building matters more than them.
And yet when people start to commit violence, there's a reaction that that's crossing the line and descending to their level. Let me play you a clip of the mayor of Atlanta, Mayor Bottoms, and get your reaction to this.
Yesterday, when I heard there were rumors about violent protests in Atlanta, I did what a mother would do. I called my son and I said, "Where are you?" I said, "I cannot protect you, and Black boys shouldn't be out today. So you're not going to out-concern me and out-care about where we are in America. I wear this each and every day, and I pray over my children each and every day. So what I see happening on the streets of Atlanta is not Atlanta. This is not a protest. This is not in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. This is chaos. A protest has purpose. When Dr. King was assassinated, we didn't do this to our city."
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, what are you thinking as you hear that clip? She's talking to her kid too.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, as a Black mother, I would probably be doing whatever I could to keep my child away from there as well. It is important to understand that with this destruction, and there have been obvious cases, I think, of some people who are coming to take advantage of the unrest and increase destruction that really isn't tied to feelings of anger, but some of it is very genuine. That Black youth in these protests are the most at risk when these things start to happen. So as a parent, as a mother, I absolutely would be terrified at the thought of my child being there. But to say that it's not protest isn't true. I think that every politician has to say that. It's your job to protect these communities, right? And to protect these businesses and to protect the people who work in and own these businesses. But I think it's really important to recognize that this is happening because of the constant extreme violence against Black people in this country. I think it's also important to recognize that when we're seeing things like, you know, your Nordstrom's and your banks and your national chains being impacted, we also aren't talking about Black businesses, right? We are talking about institutions that have regularly profited off of the labor of people of color while giving very little back. And I'm not saying that it is right or wrong, but I am saying that we need to give empathy to people who are out here whose anger has boiled over. And I'd say that we have to be continuously steering this conversation back to what is the real violence in this situation. And the truth is that capitalism has left Black people behind. Capitalism was built off of Black bodies and will never include Black people in its profits. And to see people take this out on capitalist systems, to see them take it out on systems that have harmed them, you may think that your national chain has nothing to do with this, but it does. And I don't think that we should be, that it is the answer to go out there. But what is the answer? And this is something that I was trying to ask someone the other day. What is the answer? What is the thing that works? What is the thing we haven't tried? Can you tell me? Because it's been over 400 years. And it's not like we haven't been trying. It's not like we haven't been begging and pleading and marching peacefully. Dr. King marched peacefully and he got shot in the face for it. So what are we supposed to do at this point to get people's attention? What are we supposed to do to let people understand, whether it's because they care about us or just because they don't want to deal with the hassle of our protests, that this needs to stop?
Ijoma Oluwo with us, author of So You Want to Talk About Race, and Dean in Jersey City. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi.
Do you have a story to tell from the week? Hi, Dean. Were you out over the weekend?
Yes, I was in Newark. I do live in New Jersey, and I was in Newark at the protests, and I just wanted to say that it's such a stark difference between the protests here in Newark and Camden versus in New York City. And I talked with a lot of my friends who were there, and we realized that the biggest difference is community building and the community resource, community involvement. In New York City, everyone knows most of the cops that work there tend to live in outer boroughs, upstate New York, Long Island. They don't live within the community that they're policing. Whereas in Newark or in Camden, a lot of them do live in that city, their own city. So, maybe that's what's needed. That's where we need to go. And then I know a lot of people are upset about the looting and the burning of the businesses, but somehow everyone forgot. The same thing happened in Tulsa. What about those Black businesses that were burned 100 years ago almost, And, It's almost like the whitewashing of the history, and everyone forgets, the things that were done by the white people towards people of color, and suddenly, the Wendy's going up in flame or Target getting looted is such a, national tragedy.
Yes, Dean, thank you. The white riot in Tulsa 99 years ago yesterday, and I believe that comes up in the chapter of your book called Is Police Brutality Really About Race? Because I know you go into a lot of history there. You want to talk about that at all as a kind of, root of what's going on today even?
Yeah, I think it is important that we recognize that when we look at policing in America, we have two very separate experiences and histories. Our police forces that rose from slave patrols that were rounding up, escaped Black people and sending them back into slavery have always had two missions. One is to serve and protect white America and to control Black America. And it is really hard, I think, for a lot of people to understand that the cop that they would turn to when they're in trouble is the same cop that will take the life of a Black person in times of crisis. And we have dealt with that reality. And it has been denied us. The recognition that it has always been like this for us has been denied. But we see it time and time again. We see it in statistics. This is not just emotion speaking. This is the fact that you are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in an encounter with police if you are Black, even though you are less likely to have any sort of contraband on you when you encounter police officers. We are at sometimes up to 12 times more likely to encounter violence in general in our encounters with police officers. This is the reality that we have always faced. And so our relationships with police, especially when we see time and time again that our forces are turning against community policing, are refusing to get officers living in the areas that they're policing. They're refusing to really look at bias. They're refusing to have transparent processes to deal with issues of police brutality. How are we supposed to be working with police officers? You know, what is the anger supposed to look like? Why are we supposed to be coordinating our protests with them? And so you will see in certain areas where police forces have taken more effort to really rebuild, and oftentimes it does take things like really shifting personnel, rebuilding from the ground up, retraining from the ground up, and looking at your policing practices, your prosecution practices, that you are seeing a more coordinated response in these protests. You are seeing more empathy from the officers on the streets because these are their neighbors who are feeling pain and fear instead of the population they've been told to control. And right now we are seeing militarized police who are coming into the streets and meeting hurt, angry, and scared Black people with the mission of controlling them.
Liz in Park Slope, you're on WNYC with Ijoma Oluo. Hi, Liz.
Hi, yeah. I participated in the protest last night at Barclays Center, and I just wanted to offer this observation. You know, something I witnessed from protesters was that the vast majority of them were basically begging NYPD to take a knee, to, you know, join them in solidarity, to show some empathy with regards to their pain and their suffering. And of course, there was virtually no response from police officers, and they continued to stand there expressionless. One officer laughed, which obviously only made things more painful and more difficult for protesters. And I just, you know, at one point, as the protest was coming down Flatbush Avenue and crossing Bergen near the precinct, you know, imagine there's a massive SWAT team waiting for these protesters. What if they had all been on their knee, you know, in solidarity? And we talk about reform and how we need that. You know, last I checked, these protests are about police as a collective behaving badly. And so why not in this moment reconsider how they treat these protests? Why can't taking a knee become that reform that we need?
It's a great question. And did you say that being white, you didn't feel at risk as much mm-hmm. so that you felt you were able to engage the officers on the scene last night?
Absolutely. I knew that going into it, but my sense of risk was very low. And I even inadvertently found myself directly in front of the precinct because I was going down Bergen. And they didn't, you know, give me a second look, but they were rushing to barricade basically the precinct from the protesters coming down Flatbush. But I was fine.
Liz, we really appreciate your call. And let's end, Ijoma, on a related note, because I was reading the chapter of your book last night called Talking is Great, But What Else Can I Do?, in which you note that you don't just write to increase the general knowledge, but to inspire people to action. And action takes place on something as overwhelming as racial justice, piece by piece. And so you write, vote in your local elections where your votes have more power. Get into schools and find out about achievement gaps and if Black history is only taught in February. And one of your suggestions was to white people to bear witness, to use the leverage of their privilege, your words, use the leverage of their privilege. When it's safe, make your presence known when a police officer is stopping a person of color. And you tell a story of your white mother using the leverage of her privilege in her union. So would you like to end on that as an idea that people can take with them?
Absolutely. I think that it's really important, first, if you are at the protests and you are a white person, to make sure that you are not escalating the tension in these protests, because the people who will pay for that escalation are Black and brown people on the streets. So make sure that you are not adding to that. Let the decision of the level of tension in those protests be between the Black people whose bodies are at risk and the police officers. But put yourself between Black people who are at risk and officers. One of the most powerful things that can be done at protests, if you're there, is to build a wall that protects Black people who are more likely to be brutalized in these protests, between yourself, between them and the officers. If you cannot make it out to the protests, please make sure first that you are having conversations with people who are not understanding why this is important, with other white people, other non-Black people, and telling them why this matters and why you support it. Give money to bail funds. Give resources to Black community funds, Black businesses. Make sure that you are helping in tangible ways. You know, reach out to Black people who may be disproportionately impacted emotionally, physically by this, and make sure that they have lunch, that they are taken care of, you know, that they can continue on through this. And then start looking at how your power impacts this system. The truth is right now that it is not only police, but it is prosecutors and judges who are making decisions about whether or not police are held accountable for their actions. And yet we do not vote these prosecutors out when they decline time and time and time again to hold officers accountable. And that needs to change. So start paying attention to your elections. Pay attention to your mayor, your city council, all of the people who can help hold police forces accountable, and make sure they know that their job depends on doing better. We need to start getting rid of officials who have the power to do something about this and are not.
Ijeoma Oluo, author of the best-selling book, So You Want to Talk About Race. Thank you very much for joining us on this important day.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.